Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
What's it like in teenage parent land?
Oh my God.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. Bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Steve Almond. Steve Almond is the author of 11 books of fiction and nonfiction, including the New York Times bestsellers Candy Freak and Against Football. His essays and reviews have been published in venues ranging from the New York Times Magazine to Plowshares to Poets and Writers, and his short fiction has appeared in Best American Short Stories, the Pushcart Prize, Best American Mysteries, and Best American Erotica. Almond is the recipient of grants from the Massachusetts Cultural Council and the National Endowment for the Arts. He co-hosted the Dear Sugars podcast with his pal Cheryl Strayed for 4 years and teaches creative writing at the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard and Wesleyan. He lives in Arlington, Massachusetts with his family and his anxiety. Welcome, Steve.
Welcome. Yes, accurate.
I love that that's in your bio.
I like to be upfront.
It's so relatable. I think all writers can relate to that. So you're here to talk to us about your new novel, All the Secrets of the World, which is, I think the word that I used earlier was capacious and broad and all-encompassing, and but also so granular, to steal a word that Alex likes to use, so focused and beautiful. To start, we would love to hear you read to us.
Yeah. So, you know, I am not generally known. Not that there's a large group of people saying, what about Almond's reputation? Like, I'm a small fry. But amongst the people who do know me, I am not known as a plot person. So it's really odd and unusual. Like, the plots of my short stories are like, the lonely, horny guy is lonely and horny at the beginning. At the end of the story, he is also those things. So it's a little bit odd for me to have written what amounts to kind of almost like a thriller.
Yeah.
And so it has spoiler alerts, which is, so I'm going to read from the beginning. You can hear me kind of flipping around. I'm just going to read a short scene from the beginning. And all you need to know here, I think, is that the book begins with the meeting of two teenage girls, eighth graders named Lorena Sines and Jenny Stalwart. Jenny is tall and blonde and beautiful, and she's rich. And they're paired for the science fair, Lorena and Jenny, by a well-meaning teacher who thinks, well, you know, Lorena, who's very studious and intelligent, and we find out very courageous, but who comes from a background of not poverty, but real privation. Her family, her mother and brother are both undocumented. And so she sort of learned to be invisible over the course of her life for necessity's sake. And when they meet, because this is set in 1981 in Sacramento, California, sort of at the dawn of the Reagan era, they don't just do their science fair project by Google Text or whatever, Google Pages. They actually, like, Lorena has to go into the Stalwart house. And the moment she sets foot in the Stalwart mansion, all kinds of craziness is unleashed. And the central thing that happens is both of the Stalwart parents, Rosemary, who's sort of the glamorous junior league type, and Marcus, who's kind of a shy, handsome, reclusive scientist, both of them take an unnatural interest in Lorena. And so Lorena winds up unexpectedly finding herself invited on a family camping trip. And Mr. Stalwart has Mrs. Stallworth is like, no way I'm going out into the desert. So it's just Mr. Stallworth and Jenny and Lorena and Jenny's older brother, Glenn, on this camping trip. And there's a big surprise that's going to be revealed. And it turns out that surprise involves going out into the desert at night, which Jenny decides is not for her. But Lorena is quite brave. So she winds up going out into the desert with Mr. Stallworth and Jenny's older brother, Glenn, who's kind of a jerky soccer player type. And I'll just read a little bit of what happens out in the desert. Mr. Stallworth led them into the darkness. He lugged an oversized lantern, which he set down on a small rise. Close your eyes and keep them shut until I say, do it, Glenn murmured. Okay, open. An iridescent purple light gleamed out in all directions. Lorena's eyes scrolled an ocean of sand, upon which now lay scattered scores of tiny glow-in-the-dark toys, the sort kids on TV pulled from cereal boxes. Then the toys began to move. These were living creatures, many-legged and scrabbling like tiny lobsters. Welcome to Scorpionville, Glenn said. Lorena glanced at the sand around her feet. A scorpion the length of a hairpin labored under the weight of its stinger, which hung like a fang jewel over the armored segments of its body. Don't be frightened. Mr. Stallworth was suddenly right beside her. What do you think? There. Lorena cast about for the right word, stunned to find the truth in such a simple one. They're beautiful. She could feel Mr. Stallworth inspecting her face, trying to figure out if she really meant it. He took off his glasses and began furiously polishing the lenses with the hem of his shirt. For a queer moment, Lorena imagined grabbing his glasses and tossing them away. We going to take any home? Glenn asked. Mr. Stallworth pulled a small flashlight from his pocket and swept the purple beam across the sand. We might as well see who's hunting tonight. To Lorena's astonishment, he knelt down and guided a scorpion onto his palm. The animal was the size of a matchbox. Its pinchers pawed the air. Shouldn't you have gloves? Lorena said. You just come at them from behind, Glenn said. They can't sting backwards. They're not aggressive animals, Mr. Stallworth explained. They just want to be left alone. Tell her about the dance, Glenn said. Mr. Stallworth let the scorpion scuttle from one hand to the next. Yes, you might like this. During courtship, the scorpions grasp each other's pedipalps, their pinchers. They perform a kind of dance. It's called the promenade à deux. It looks like they're fighting, but it's just the opposite. It's how they select a mate. Mr. Stallworth returned his focus to the animal. You see these little hairs along their legs, he said. This is how they hunt, by touch, by vibration. They can register the movement of a single grain of sand from 10 yards away. Why do they shine? Lorena said. Nobody knows, Mr. Stallworth replied. Fluorescence must convey some kind of evolutionary advantage, but it's still their little secret. Glenn asked his father to find a scorpion he could pick up. Mr. Stallworth scanned the ground with his magic light. These are your best bet, he said. Sand scorpions. Aren't they poisonous? Lorena said. This species isn't too bad. She watched Mr. Stallworth gently prod the scorpion onto Glenn's hand. The creature scampered along his knuckles. It looked glum, menacing, painfully shy. Are you going to pick one up? Glenn asked Lorena. I'm sure she's had enough excitement for one night, Mr. Stallworth said. I'm not scared. The words came out louder than Lorena intended. More softly, she added, I'd like to hold one. Mr. Stallworth switched on the lantern. He stared at her face again, half in wonder, and picked up another one, bluish under the light. A gentle species, he said. It sting no worse than a wasp. She reached out, and Mr. Stallworth uncurled her fingers. The earth was trembling beneath her. Then she realized that it was her, and not the earth. You don't have to do this, Mr. Stallworth said. I know. Do you trust me? She met his gaze and nodded, and Mr. Stallworth lowered the animal onto her. No way, Glenn said. The creature clung to the knob of her wrist like a charm. Slowly, tentatively, it began to move toward her hand, the legs rising and falling like jointed oars. Lorena's pulse lurched. She closed her eyes to keep from flinching. Tiny feet tickled her palm. She felt the dampness beneath her clothes, the dizziness of what was going to happen next. When she could stand it no longer, she opened her eyes. The scorpion was perched on her thumb, perfectly still, its stinger hoisted like a tiny scythe He appears to like you, Mr. Stallworth said. And it just gets creepier from there, folks.
I'm so glad you read a part with the scorpions, because it's something that comes back in a lot of different ways throughout the book. You know, we've got Nancy Reagan and her astrologer, and, you know, talking about how Tony is a Scorpio. And then, of course, Lorena's interest in scorpions and Marcus's. And I just want to hear from you. Did it start with scorpions for you? Like, when did the scorpions come in?
Well, maybe 25, 30 years ago, when I was a reporter in El Paso, straight out of college, I was actually taken out into the desert, and I had the exact experience that Lorena had.
Wow.
Having these scorpiologists, you know, literally just walk me out into a patch of desert that I assumed was completely barren and empty. And they flicked on this ultraviolet light, and suddenly there were thousands
of
glow in the dark scorpions all around me, like this invisible world. And of course, the book is very much about the conflict within Lorena of wanting to be, you know, having learned to be invisible and suddenly becoming visible. And she's so desperate. She knows she needs to stay hidden because her family is undocumented. She can't come to the attention of, you know, the authorities or anyone else. She really needs to keep invisible, but she's so desperate to be seen and understood, and even, as we discover, desired. And she really comes alight under the glow of the stalwarts, especially Marcus, but Rosemary and Jenny as well. And the more I thought about scorpions, the more I realized they seem to us like this species that's completely primitive and alien and frightening. But like that description of those tiny hairs along their legs and how they can feel a single grain of sand moving 10 yards away, that to me, guys, is like sitting at my family dinner table, like how incredibly sensitive human beings are, mm-hmm. how much they can read the vibe of the people they love just from a tiny gesture, even at a distance. And the same thing is true. I think scorpions are a species that see themselves as the victim, as prey, as something that has to remain hidden. And at the same time, they're perceived as, and they really are in other contexts, quite predatory. And to me, that was also a great sort of metaphor for the human arrangement, where we constantly think of ourselves as the injured party or the potential victim, even as we're behaving in ways that are destructive. And so many of the characters in the book, including Lorena herself, behave in this way, where one part of them is brave and maybe even dangerous and risk-taking, and another part of them is inhibited and frightened.
It feels to me like we were just talking about being parents. It feels to me like being a parent as well.
Absolutely.
Just sort of like always wounded and heartbroken, but at the same time, like, you know, staunch.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kids are very much sort of speaking always and sort of instinctually in a kind of code. There's a part of them that does want to be seen and understood and accepted. And there's another part of them that needs to protect their sense of self, and they need mm-hmm. to disappear or be invisible or not be noticed. And Lorena is one of those exceptional people. When the muse walked her into my imagination, I was like, this is the horse I'm going to ride on, because mm-hmm. like every great hero or heroine, she's really so ambitious and courageous and so hungry for a larger life. But of course, for her, like Jane Eyre or whoever else, that desire, that ambition is ultimately really dangerous to her and her people.
Mm-hmm.
At the top, Steve, you'd mentioned that this was a book that took 30 years to complete. Obviously, you published many, many books and had many lives in between beginning and finishing and publishing this book. But I was so curious about, over the course of that time, how much the shape of this narrative changed, how much your specific interests within the narrative ebbed and flowed, if what you had really ended up being a much more polished version of what you started with. I'd really just kind of love to hear the story of this novel, of how it came to be, and why the amount of time, why taken off. Right. I would love to hear it.
Yeah. Well, I it's a story I'm happy to tell you, though I'm depressed to have to sort of admit that it took me so long to figure out how to write a novel. I carried through so much of my career this internal voice. It's like, okay, you've written these nonfiction books and you've written some books of stories, but you're really essentially a failed novelist, and you can never really get this form down. And there's a real reason for that. It's so, to me anyway, it was so excruciatingly difficult to master a big plot. And what I think what in previous iterations of this novel and many other failed novels that I have, you know, sort of stinking away in drawers, I hadn't figured out what Aristotle calls the artful arrangement of incidents, by which he really means a chain of consequence. Not just this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened, but this happened. And because this happened, this next thing happened, and therefore this next thing. And once I discovered that chain of consequence, because Lorena walks into the Stallworth mansion, she comes to the attention of the Stallworth parents. Because of that, she's desperate to get their attention and regard. Because of that, Marcus's desire is activated. Because of that, and on and on and on. And once I figured out that the novel was really going to be about Lorena getting herself and her family into a lot of trouble inadvertently, and then the question of whether she was going to be able to rescue them and save her people, it really gave me something that was pulling me through the book, where in previous versions, I was sort of pushing Lorena and the other characters around, kind of hoping they would bump into the big ticket items, like internal conflict and self-revelation and desire and ruin and so forth. And it really just took me a long time to figure out also how all of these characters' individual trajectories were going to collide with one another. And, you know, I wish I could say I'm just slow at figuring out the mechanisms of plot and the larger architecture of how a novel has to take shape. Once I figured it out, I started writing in earnest probably 2014.
Oh, wow.
The final version of what was going to become All the Secrets of the World. Then I put it down for a couple of years because you might recall we had this election in 2016, which I
said. Yeah.
Sorry, but it happened. Like a lot of artists or writers, it really knocked me off my game. I could not stay in this fictional world, which was so compelling to me, but it felt like the pressure of the real, what was happening in the real world, sort of sent me off on a couple of nonfiction projects. One of, you know, a book that was partly a literary investigation of the forces that led to that election. I just needed to work that out for myself. And that became a book. But when I came back to Secrets, it was such a different world. It was 2018, 2019. Mm-hmm. And people like Lorena, and especially her older brother, Tony, who's undocumented and who traveled from Central America and was taken by a parent at a young age on a, you know, 1,000-mile really ordeal through several countries and up into the United States. Like those families were being torn apart at the border. Mm-hmm. The US mm-hmm. government was in the business of literally permanently traumatizing those children and their parents. And I think that really changed the direction that the novel ultimately turned in. I knew that I needed to really write about the criminalization of the American dream, which I think is what the US immigration system is about, for certain people from certain countries with a certain skin tone and who speak a certain language. We basically say the American dream is a crime. If you want to pursue it, you're going to be treated as a criminal. And for me, I think that's why the novel turned in the dark direction it did. I didn't realize it, but I was writing a social novel. Mm-hmm. And when you're writing a social novel, your job really is to show what happens when people without power collide with big systems of power that they have to live within.
What I love about now knowing all that, Steve, is it makes the novel more impressive to me because you really do not play your hand narratively at all early on. You get through book one, and I didn't, other than page count, I did not have a sense of how broad the scope of the narrative was going to be, right, how sweeping, how many characters would become central to the plot.
Right.
And the how quick the rotation through POVs would be, especially as the book progressed, in a way that I as a reader love. I love that kind of reading experience. And it's so wonderful to hear that even though this book took a long time to write, and even though, you know, took a lot less time once you sat down in earnest, it sounds like, wow, there was a kind of preservation of the sanctity of the characters in a way that I mean, that's a crazy way to say it. But what I mean is that everything that's to come, the social interests of the novel, the exploration of the American dream, as you were just talking about, that's present early on, but not in a way that feels thematically onerous. You know, I love that it starts off and you're really just reading about two girls living their lives in the mm-hmm. best way. I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah, no, and I was unaware of that, Alex. I mean, I think if I'd said, I'm going to write a big, ambitious social novel, that's what I'll do, I would have gotten intimidated and I would have gotten self-conscious and I would have overwritten it. And I think I needed to sort of organically understand as I wrote that the more I encountered new characters, the more I was determined to figure out, okay, if there are police involved, I don't want them to be flattened out into like the hard-bitten detective. Mm-hmm. I want to understand why Pedro Guerrero makes the decisions he makes. And the only way I can understand that is if I travel into his past and understand who he was and, you know, why he became a police officer. And the same is true of every single character, where the more I got to know them, the more determined I was to see them as round and complex. Mm-hmm. Even Nancy Reagan, who, by the way, I spent 40 years in my mind sort of caricaturing as this modern Marie Antoinette with her China patterns and her ditzy astrology, really took moving into her point of view to realize, well, she is, like many powerful entitled people, you know, unaware of the damage that she's doing, but also she's a traumatized spouse mm-hmm. who saw her beloved husband almost get killed, you know, a bullet being, you know, lodged, you know, half an inch from his heart, or, you know, quarter of an inch. And so she adopted a belief system that she thought would keep her beloved safe. And any mm-hmm. of us would do the same. I mean, I'm a strong believer that novelists and writers in general, we're the fools in charge of forgiveness. It is not acceptable. You have to simply flatten out any character who's really who you're going to deeply examine. So as I was moving through the book, in every moment I was thinking, I don't want this to just be a police procedural. I don't want this to just be a kind of YA book. I don't want this to just be a desert walkabout. I want to use every scene to try to understand who these characters are and why they make the decisions they make, so that the reader doesn't see any of them as a villain or a victim, but as what most human beings are, which is some confounding combination of the two, including Lorena, who mm-hmm. makes decisions that she comes to see are, she's complicit in much of what happens to mm-hmm. her. There's big systems that are aligned against her, but she has agency and she is courageous and in some ways naive. And, you know, she doesn't listen to her mother, and she makes decisions that put everybody in danger, herself included. So I really had that feeling, and maybe some of it was being in my 50s and sort of saying, you know what, if I'm going to write a book, I'm going to take a swing. And that's mm-hmm. why it's separated into separate books, because I wanted, it's not chapters. I want people to know we're in a different book now. And it's all part of the same larger story, but there is a shift in tone and in point of view, the way the book is written. And I know that for some readers, like some agents, you know, got the book and they're like, well, I liked the beginning, but then I kind of wasn't interested, or I loved the scenes out in the desert, but I wasn't interested in the other stuff. And I know that's a risk to go broad and to write a social novel. Most books burrow into a single character's consciousness and sort of we see it always from their point of view. But again, when you're writing a social novel, the idea is that you have to get inside all of the characters to understand not what they did right or wrong, but why they make the decisions they make.
Do you think that's why you were able to get into the mindset of a teenage Latina and Nancy Reagan and a man who seduces teenage girls without sort of like yeah. stopping yourself and saying, wait a minute, am I yeah. allowed to write this? Or, oh my God, do I want to go there?
Yeah. I mean, look, there, I didn't even think about that stuff, Lindsay, to be honest. I know that there are major issues. You know, we're in an era, rightfully, where underrepresented voices are needing to tell their stories. And the literary world, thank God, is a precinct of the culture that's saying, hey, history is just the story of destructive, you know, white guys. Like, we need other stories, because there are lots of people who have not been allowed to tell their stories. And ideally, it should be the people who have lived those lives who tell those stories. But I honestly, I have to go with what the muse supplies me. And when Lorena Sines walked into my imagination, I knew that I was so, I was in awe of her. I was shocked by her courage and her intelligence and her cunning. And she was the engine of it for me. I never said, do I have the right to write this or not? But I did say, especially in drafts 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, hey, if I'm going to write from a position of privilege about all these characters who are so different and have led lives so different from my own, I better get it right or mm-hmm. die trying. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time trying to figure out getting, you know, sort of sensitivity reads from people. I had the book read by fellow reporters who'd worked on the border and understood immigration, and by a woman who grew up under the same circumstances essentially as Lorena, and by a police officer who was working at that time in California, and just a whole bunch of friends of mine who I said to them, am I getting anything wrong? I worked really hard to try to find empathy for all the characters, and to also make sure that the story really belongs to the characters. I did not want to have a narrator saying, now, dear reader, you see the moral lesson here. That's not how a good social novel operates. A good social novel is not about saying, here's the lesson that should be imparted. It's about leading the reader into their own moral confusions and making them feel really implicated by the ways in which all of us are corrupt and all of us make, you know, destructive decisions that we can't see at the time. So I was quite determined to make sure that I was being forgiving and fair and fully understanding the characters. And I just didn't think, oh my gosh, should I, do I have the right to write this or not? I was simply way more interested in what is going to happen to Lorena, what's going to happen to Tony, what's going to happen to Graciela, you know, what is Guerrero going to help? Is the police officer, you know, in question going to be able to help Lorena sort of bring some version of justice to bear? And those questions ultimately are a lot more interesting than the author's own questions, even though I think it's fair and necessary for an author of privilege, a white dude like me, to think, hey, I need to make sure, if I'm going to write from a position of privilege about marginalized characters, that I get it right, or as right as I can. I think that's an important thing for me to be thinking about. But if I'm only thinking about that, I think it actually keeps me from fully entering into what novelists are supposed to do. It's our job mm-hmm. description, mm-hmm. which is enter into the consciousness of other people and walk in their shoes and try to understand who they are and how they operate. And, you know, that's not an excuse for sloppy or lazy writing. Well, I you know, if anybody finds the book exploitative, that opinion is, I'm not going to argue with it. That is the reader's right. But my responsibility as a novelist is to tell the stories that I feel called to tell. And if I'm constantly worrying about whether I have permission or not, I just can't be in that improvisatory flow that is like the state you need to be in when you're making a book.
Mm-hmm. I just want to hear a little bit more about your relationship with the muse that you've mentioned.
It's intermittent and vexing.
Do you... are you someone who needs the muse to visit before you can sit down and write something, or is it something that you're like, okay, you know, it'll come to me when it comes. In the meantime, I'm working on this over here.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, Lindsay, I think that is like, I try to keep busy. This is probably my journalism background, but to me, it's like, okay, if I'm working on a short story or a novel, I consider that to be something that's really tough to do, because you have to be separated from, consciously, from the world that's swirling around. We all have kids, you know, that you're constantly thinking about them. Are they okay? What's going on with my partnership? What's going on with the bills and the drop-offs and pickups? There's a lot of stuff to push us out of that imaginative space. So I don't sit there and say, I'm going to just, you know, work on a beautiful piece of art every day. That's just not how I roll. Many days I'm saying, I'm going to do some money work. I'm going to write an article. I'll do some manuscript consulting. I'm going to read a book that is really interesting to lead a book group discussion, or I teach. And so I'm reading student work a lot and reading the assignments that we'll talk about in class. And there's a lot of stuff that I do that is not anywhere close to the creative act of being in that flow state. And in fact, I found over the pandemic that I needed to just go spend a week at a cheap Airbnb or something in order to get far enough from the pressures of my life that I could be with Lorena in her world, and Guerrero and the Stalwarts and the rest of them. So and I try to be, what I say to writers generally and students of writing is, if you are experiencing something that sounds like writer's block, which is like writer depression, it's really self-doubt. And it's that inhibiting voice that says, oh, it's never going to go anywhere and it's no good. And it keeps you from even trying. So my solution to writer's block is set the bar as low as possible.
Yes.
And, you know, all this American nonsense about like everything's got to be, you just should be pooping out gold. Like, forget it. Sometimes you don't have it. And I oftentimes, when that's the case, I do a different kind of writing, or I use my mind in another way and just hope that somebody like Lorena comes along, or a story idea or a voice that captures me and that's ultimately more interesting than the other kinds of work that I might do. Interesting enough that my ego is no longer the issue. I mean, your goal as a writer is to be more interested in the story you're telling than anything else.
I feel like the character that would be, I was just, you know, obviously as a writer, I'm reading this book thinking about how I would tackle some of it, or what would be a real challenge, I feel like. And I feel like the character of Marcus would be tough, because I feel like it would be so easy to have him take over the novel. And was it difficult to modulate how evil is such a terrible way to put it, but how heinous Marcus's acts were? Was it difficult to modulate how big of a role he ended up playing in the final narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the key for me was to say, in what is lodged in Marcus's past that makes him behave in this way, that makes him have these destructive desires. And it took me pushing him out into the desert and trying to figure out, how did this guy grow up? What story was he born into? And once I understood that he sees in Lorena kind of a version of himself, that is somebody who's born into very difficult circumstances. And even in as we come to discover, you know, was in an abusive household, and really had to struggle to make a larger life for himself and never fully recovered from that experience of abuse. You know, what you've experienced, the pain you've experienced, gets put out into the world and onto the world. And once I understood that, I found it easier to allow him to play a role in the book. And to, again, when you're talking about somebody who has behaviors and desires that he does, I think it's really important, if he's going to even be a point of view character, that he is not flattened out. You know, we all have our own version of destructive, unwholesome desires. And I hate when we draw these lines and say, well, that person is beyond the pale. We're all beyond the pale. We all have moments and phases and urges that are despicable and unthinkable, whether it's, you know, I mean, as parents, you guys know that there are moments where you just look at those kids and you're like, boy, I'm glad there's nothing sharp around here. we don't like to say it, right? But it's true. It's in there. Mm-hmm. And with Marcus, I think what was important was for me to see what is underneath these destructive behaviors, and then to put him in an environment, to contrive a plot in which he's sort of forced into a world that is saying something that he knows is not true, which is God wants you to do this. It's okay for you to have these illicit destructive desires. It is God's way. And for me, that was a real chance to explore the sort of the belief systems that we hold. Are we a person of science and rationality, or are we a person of faith and superstition? And, you know, that's part of the astronomy, astrology kind of thing that I got interested in exploring. I really feel like the book that's primarily about Marcus is really about how human beings devise a belief system that justifies how they think and feel and behave.
I really love that there are times, though, that you see Marcus as just like your typical angry dad.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
With Glenn. And I could see him so clearly in those moments.
It's heartbreaking. You know, Glenn is a minor character, but there's a scene in that camping trip where they're out, where they're, you know, outside the fire, and Lorraine is sort of listening for when am I going to get my chance to possibly get a little FaceTime with Mr. Stallworth, who she has a massive crush on, right? But she hears Glenn desperately looking for his father's approval for some way to get on his radar. And, you know, that's me and my dad. That's every kid and their father or their mother, where there's that universal desire to be sort of seen and understood and sympathized with. And Marcus is a pretty unforgiving person. He's tough on himself and he's tough on his family. And he comes from a past that makes his children seem to him very spoiled and entitled. And, you know, he can't really give them the mercy and understanding and trust ultimately that he does kind of give to Lorena. That relationship also began in early drafts of the book, was much more rooted in like physical desire and illicit, all that stuff. And it took me a lot of drafts to understand that these two people are, they feel a kinship with one another. They understand one another intuitively. They both have scientific minds and brilliance that has allowed them, that is sort of their path out of a difficult circumstance.
I love that you put Vera Rubin in this book.
Good.
I thought that was so great. I love that you just felt comfortable putting real people in. I mean, Nancy Reagan is the main example, but
part of the book is really about like all the systems that are stacked against Lorena. One of them is just patriarchy. And she's a woman, a young woman of real intelligence. And part of what she's up against is that if you want to be a scientist, that's a world dominated by men. And here's Vera Rubin, who in a crucial moment enters the narrative and shows her, hey, you can be a scientist of consequence, but you are going to be swimming upstream. You're going to have to work twice as hard and settle for half the credit you deserve, but it is possible. And for me as a teacher, the book was partly about the role, that the hugely consequential role that the right teacher can play at the right time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Vera Rubin becomes one of those teachers for Lorena. You've got Miss Catalyst at the beginning, who's, you know, telling these stories about, you know, and that was a fun thing, sort of an Easter egg to plant, where at the beginning, she's telling the story about, you know, Margaret Mitchell, mm-hmm. this early astronomer who was Vera Rubin's kind of hero and lodestar. And I just like that idea of this kind of this daisy chain of consequence, where unknowingly Miss Catalyst is suggesting, you know, is introducing the idea of it is possible to make a life in the sciences of learning. And I think in that way, Marcus Stallworth is really important and a positive force in, you know, in Lorena's life. He's the one who says to her, there's an invisible world at your feet, and there's also a world above you in the stars that is one of unbelievable splendor. And, you know, that is the, he's the first person, Miss Catalyst as well, but he's the first person outside of school who says to her, like, you're brilliant and you need to look at the world around you and try to understand it. That's what you've been called to do. Don't you understand?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, you know, beautiful, even though there's another part of him that's completely messed up and destructive. And, you know, Lorena gets into a lot of trouble, kind of having a crush on him. But this is what I mean about the complexity that a novel can offer. It isn't just, oh, that terrible, awful person. It's like, people's interactions, you don't just get good stuff or bad stuff, you get both.
Steve, this book is published with a new press. Tell us a little bit about Zando. Tell us a little bit about your experience publishing with them.
Yeah, Zando is a new publisher. You know, Emily Stern is quite a well-known figure, and she basically left traditional publishing and said, well, I want to start a new publisher and I want to solve the problem of discoverability. I want to figure out how to, rather than the standard model, like we're going to publish 50 books a year and kind of throw them up against the wall and hope one or two of them stick. I think she had the feeling we have got to be more targeted and figure out how to find the right audience for the right book and not publish a ton of books, publish a smaller number of books and figure out how to find the audience that's been waiting for that book. I also had the great fortune of having an editor, Emily Bell, who'd been whoop, whoop. Emily Bell?
No, I said whoop whoop because she was my editor at FSG.
Okay, so you know then. I mean,
oh, like, yes.
You know, Emily is, the thing that's amazing about her is she was so, she said, you know what you're doing here. I just need you to turn some dials. And her comments were so brilliant and spot on, but not insistent. She wasn't like, you have to do this. Mm-hmm. And I found myself, Lindsay, going through the manuscript and being like, she is right every single time. And not only is she right every single time, but she's right. What she's saying here also applies to some other places. So in the standard model where your editor, like, demands 150 edits and you're like, well, I'll make 73 and that's my final offer. In this case, she was like, she had about 23 things to say. And I was like, you know what? I need to make like 123 edits. What you're saying here is so accurate that I need to make other edits that will make the book even stronger. Like, her advice was so gently delivered, but it was so precise.
Yeah, she's so California about it.
Oh yeah, that's the other thing, is she's like, unbelievably laid back.
Mm-hmm.
She sent me this, it's funny because it's right on the wall next to me, but like when they bought the book, she sent me this note. I'm gonna just like read it to you, even though you might have to edit it out because it has a swear word, which is very Emily. She's like, Steve Almond Joy, welcome to Zano. I promise you I won't fuck this up. Signed, Emily Bell.
Yep.
And I was like, the moment I got that with a box of like nice chocolate, I was like, yeah, everything's gonna be just fine.
Yeah, she is. She's very laid back about it, but razor sharp and so clear-eyed and confident.
Yeah. It's a rare combo for somebody to be totally a high-achieving badass, but also weirdly laid back. It's very unsettling to me. I always feel like I'm quivering with anxiety. And she's just like, yeah, whatever. We'll find a pub date. Let's not worry about it too much. I'm like, but it's my job to worry.
I know. And she's like younger than me, which is also uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, everybody's younger than me, but I was like, yeah. Yeah. It's always a little bit annoying when people who are younger than me are both more poised and wiser. But I was also like, whatever. She's working on behalf of the book. So I'm just super psyched. And I just thought they did a really beautiful job with the, you know, I really like the cover. I know it sort of says like thriller, but I get it. It is a thriller and it's like a social thriller. And I love most of all that Emily, when I spoke with her, I was like, you know, I know that it changes point of view and I know it's all these different books. And she's like, dude, that's why we like it. We like it, you know? We like that you're taking a big swing. We like that it has these broader ambitions. Like, you don't have to apologize for it. That's why we're having this discussion. And I was like, but can't I worry some more?
Give me something else to worry about, please.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I think I've told this story before on the podcast, but when I got my copy edits back from my first novel that I did with her, It's written in like vernacular in some ways. And there's a lot of like comma splices and for rhythm's sake. And it was my first novel. And so I was like accepting all of the copy edits and I sent it back to her and she was like, no. She's like, you need to stet most of these. She was like, this is your voice. This is how you write. And that's why we're publishing it.
That
I was blown away by that.
That is pro level right there.
I know.
Yeah, to go against the copy editor, just to know the rhythm as she does.
Yep, exactly. How does it feel now that it's finally finished and out in the world?
Oh, I'm just totally psyched. I mean, I accepted. The weird thing is I spent all these years and decades like saying, oh, like I'm a failed novelist. And once I actually finished the book, to be honest, and it's not like I was like, oh, well, this is a masterpiece. But I just knew that after so many failures and struggling with the idea for this book and the execution of it and so many other crappy novels, I was like, look, I know that I did the thing that I set out to do. I saw my character into danger and I saw them through it. And it doesn't have to be published. I would love it if it was, but the thing that I needed to prove to myself was if you would just relax and let yourself, the muse will allow you to execute on a big, ambitious story. And so in a certain way, I had accepted in my mind, like, this might never get published. It's definitely not a great time for a person of insane privilege like me, a white dude, to write a big social novel with lots of point of view characters from characters who are marginalized. And I accepted that. I was like, you know what? But that's different than the internal feeling that you have when you know you did your best. And, you know, like, you know that you did the thing that you sat down to do. There's a certain gratification that's intrinsic in that. And so everything else is kind of gravy. Like, I'm so delighted that Zando, you know, bought it and that Emily and this great team put it out into the world. But the thing that I wanted to do was to really honor the agreement I had with Lorena and the story that she has to tell the world. And once that was done, and I felt like, you know, successfully, that was the thing that I was looking for. The rest is really great and I'm delighted, but it's not at the heart of it.
Will you ever do it again?
God knows. I mean, the thing is I guess at age 90, I'll like have my second. if the past is a prediction, like it's probably going to be in my 90s and be like, I got another one.
And Alice and I will still be doing this. So
right.
We'll have you.
Yeah, good. I'd be like, hey, you guys. You guys will be asking the same question over and over, and I'll be answering just a single question over and over. And we'll be like, yeah, that was awesome. But I mean, I don't, the thing that is amazing to me is that people like write a novel and then they just like write another one. I'm going to need some time to like, I think, sort of recharge and to figure out what will honestly like carry me through a big long project, because I feel like writing is the whole ball game is outlasting your doubt. And even though I've published books and I sort of have some little mid-list record, the central voice inside me is like, you're pretty much a failure. You're not going to do this again. I'm plagued by doubt, and like my job really is to outlast the doubt and for the story I want to tell to be more interesting than my ego drama about are you good enough and are you smart and eloquent and all that stuff. And so I've got to find another story where I just get more interested in the story than all that other crap, because I've had the other experience many times where I just jump into the next novel and say, no, this time, and just push the characters around. And I don't want to do that. I think it's really a waste of, you know, it's a waste of my time, my limited time and attention. So I'm going to wait until I have another great story, probably arriving somewhere in my late 80s, my early 90s. I'll be knocking on your door again.
Well, you're always invited.
That's right. And whatever it is, Steve, we look forward to it. We both really enjoyed the hell out of this novel.
Yes.
And, thank you so much for talking with us tonight. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I mean, you guys know this as writers, like the biggest compliment that somebody can pay you is like, I read your book.
That's true.
That is so true.
They don't have to say anything else.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I actually read, you guys said a lot of kind and potentially fraudulent things about your enjoyment.
That sounded not, earnest, but we would never.
I know, but you know what I mean? Like, what's more important is just like, to me, did somebody read it through to the end? And it's such a huge compliment when it's, you know, a novel, because that's a big commitment. And so anybody who reads the book, if they send me a note or they tell me that, I'm just like, thank you so much. I know that took a lot of your time. I hope it was like worthwhile.
Well, it was. And we recommend it. It was a really, like you're saying, it's a social novel. It's partly a thriller, but it's really, really fun to read. It's just, it's a great book.
Thank you.
That was good.
That was good. It was fun to talk to him. It's a interesting story about how the novel came to be, and it's a very good novel.
This was the first like thing I got in the mail that included like all the swag. Mm. Like, it came with its own horoscope cards and like a bunch of other stuff. My kids took it all.
Of course.
It was like really like packed in this really amazing box, and you know, like, you've seen people get like swag boxes for movies or books or whatever, and it was my first time getting something like that, and I felt so cool.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Zando. And it came out like in the spring, and we couldn't have him on then because of scheduling, but really glad we got to talk to him, and I'm really glad I read the book. It was awesome and so inspiring to just be like, you know what, these characters are speaking to me, and I have to honor that.
Mm. One of my favorite things as a reader is just when there's a hard transition into another POV and the writer pulls it off. And that happens several times in this novel. It was enjoyable.
That is so true. Or like, even when like you're with them in the moment, mm-hmm. and then you get this little peek at like, actually what happens later is blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm. I actually marked that first one.
Yeah.
It was so good. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. I was thinking to myself, I think I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to make a list. Have I already said this? I'm going to make a list of all the things I love reading in books. And I'm just going to write those scenes featuring the same character. And that's going to be my next novel.
I love like, that.
I love like when people are like when they talk about what groceries they're buying.
Mm-hmm.
I love when people throw money to like solve something.
Mm-hmm.
I love like sex scenes.
I didn't realize you were going to actually fucking list the things. It's amazing.
I know. There's more, but I can't remember. There's like a lot. There's less lame ones.
I was listening to Elizabeth Strout on Other People,
mm-hmm.
and Brad asked her, you know, how she goes about writing her novels. And she said that she does not write sequentially, and that she basically does what you just described. Like, she'll picture her character, and if there's if she can just imagine a scene with the character, she'll write it, like whatever has heat, and then she'll just write another one and another one, and then she'll just eventually figure out how they are pieced together.
I love that.
I know. I had never heard that. And it was really interesting. It made total sense though, because how often, you know, are you either sequentially or just within your thinking on, you know, end up writing a scene that maybe you don't feel ready emotionally or intellectually to write, and you end up just kind of whatever doing, you know.
I think, oh God, I think it was Matt Bell, or no, maybe it was, did I already talk about this, this Lit Hub essay that Carter Bays wrote? I was telling my students about it. He said, stop focusing on the how and just focus on the what. So like, not how is this story going, you know, like, how are they going to get where I need them to go, but focus on like, okay, I know there's a scene where this happens. I'm going to write that scene. And now I know there's this other scene I want to write. And I feel like that is a way to keep momentum and stop yourself from getting bogged down in like, you know, I'm a stupid loser who's bad at plot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the new Other People episode?
I don't know. There's so many of them. Oh, okay. It's very, very recent. It's either like the most recent or I don't know, a week or two ago or something. It was great. It was really good.
She's so awesome.
I've never read her and I feel like I'm going to love her. So I'm kind of like putting it off.
You would love Olive Kittredge.
Yeah.
Do you ever do that?
Do you ever just like delay getting into somebody? Cause I want to be able to have a little bit of time and read them all.
Yes, for sure. There's tons of, I feel like I've only just read one Lydia Millett.
Probably Millett, but I don't
Millett.
Know.
Yeah. I've only read one of hers and I feel like that's a whole Dana Spiota, same thing.
Oh my God. I love her.
I've only read one Shirley Hazzard.
What? Me too. Only one Shirley Hazzard. What was the Lydia Millett you've read?
The Children's Bible.
Oh, okay. The most recent one, right?
I feel like there was one after that.
Oh, wow. Holy shit.
Now there's another one called Dinosaurs that is coming out.
God damn it. I feel like Children's Bible just came out in my head.
I know. Let me see. We're gonna solve this mystery. Lydia Millett. Let's do it. Books. What you been up to, girl? Nope. I think you might be... Wait. Can you just give them to me like... No, I think you are right. I think that was the most recent. And now Dinosaurs is coming out.
She has amazing titles for her novels.
Yes.
I absolutely love those titles.
Yes. Pills and Starships. George Prince. George Bush, Dark Prince of Love.
These are just like every single one I fucking love. Oh, Pure and Radiant Heart, Omnivores, Pills and Starships, Sweet Lamb of Heaven. These are fucking... How could she... Obviously, she's a genius.
Yes, she is.
You got anything going on in your life or everything's nice and easy, right? Nothing?
I got a new illness. Oh, God. I'm happy to report.
You personally?
Me, yeah. I don't know. I woke up with something. I've been feeling terrible all day. I'm reading a really great book. It's by Rachel Aviv.
I keep seeing this about, right? Everyone's posting this pic.
Great cover. Speaking of white sparse covers with just, you know, words. We were talking to Deborah Shapiro about that.
Sure.
Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. Cool. And she's sort of examining like this moment in time between when a person is experiencing mental illness and then is diagnosed and starts talking about their lives with mental illness. So the story sort of changes. So she's like, what, you know, there's like that space in between where it's not labeled and you're not like viewing everything through that. And people aren't treating you like, oh, well, the so-and-so has bipolar or is schizophrenic or OCD or whatever. There's like this space where she feels like is an interesting space to examine. And so it's that like case studies. Awesome. It's great. She starts with her own story. And like when she was six, she became anorexic for a brief period. And she says, you know, cause she was six, she didn't really care what the psychiatrists were saying. So she
didn't, say six,
6 years old. Yeah. And it wasn't, it was more of like a childlike, fasting on Yom Kippur and not wanting to gain weight like one of her classmates. And also her parents were going through a very stressful divorce. And so it was like a way of, I don't know, controlling things. But she said because she was so young, like the psychiatrist calling it anorexia and talking to her or her parents about it in front of her, it just kind of went over her head. So then she just like randomly started eating again. And wasn't anorexic after that, as far as I can tell. And so it wasn't like this part of the narrative of her life. It wasn't like it didn't set her life's course or whatever that moment. Anyway, I find that so interesting because I do feel like there's this thought that if we can label what it is people are experiencing, then there's a way of like explaining like, oh, well, that's why, you know, these triggers are hard for this person, or that's why this person needs this medication or this kind of therapy. But it can also sort of like push you into this narrative. God. Anyway, it's great. It's really good. I love case studies. I guess that's what these would be. I read this one when I was living in New York 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, this book. And in one of the case studies, this man was like clogging public toilets and waiting in the stall next to the clogged toilet. And it was a women's bathroom, and the women would poop and they wouldn't be able to flush it, and they would leave, and he would take the poop and eat it.
Damn. Do you know what's funny is
if anyone knows what that book is called, please tell me. I've been trying to find it ever since.
Lindsay wants to take it to Kinko's, get that thing printed up as a poster.
It was actually,
and
it was
put it above the bed.
It was so poignant. His father had told him all his life that he was a disgusting, no good, whatever. And so he started to inhabit that mindset. I'm disgusting. Right. Mm-hmm. Oh God. No. Okay. Anyway, what?
What? When you were describing the Rachel Aviv 6-year-old anorexia, I had, for some reason, I haven't thought about this in like, honestly, 20 years, probably. I probably said 20 because you just said 20, many years. But I remember, I'm just going to tell you this memory. It's unrelated. It's related, unrelated.
Okay.
This is just an embarrassing childhood thing. So I was in first grade. And a class, this is so bad, classmate of mine got cancer. The medication that he had to take caused him to be like very bloated.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, I was so fucking jealous of this kid because he got so much attention. Because he was like, everybody's parents would be like, all right, he's not fat. It's okay. Even if he was, it's okay. He's just bloated because of the medication, because he has fucking childhood cancer. Be nice to him. So everyone would like bring him stuff and be like, I don't remember what his name was, but like, oh, you know, whatever. You'd be so nice to him. And I remember thinking, just pure rage. Like, so I was like, God damn it. It's like, I want that attention that the kid with cancer is getting. And, that's my memory, and I'm a bad person.
Okay, first of all, John Mulaney has a whole bit about that.
God.
He had some, I can't remember exactly what the story was, but he was so jealous of some classmate's personal tragedy. But when I was a kid in fourth grade, my best friends, the twins across the street, Katie and Alexia, shout out Katie and Alexia, their mom got in a terrible car accident. She was like hit by a Frito-Lay truck.
Jesus.
And, yeah. And she was in the hospital and it was terrible. And I was so fucking jealous. That's terrible. Like I was like, I have to somehow insert myself into this tragedy. Okay. This is like the best friend of my, the mom of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
This also involves me, you know, like my neighbor right across the street. I practically lived over there. And I like my sweet fourth grade teacher somehow saw that I needed attention as well. And like, she was going to take them for a sleepover at her house and like a day at the mall and like go out to lunch. And she took me as well.
What a great teacher.
When it came time for the sleepover, I had to go home because the sleepover was just for them.
It's a bridge too far.
Isn't that so nice? Because I feel like I would have been like, you're being a little pissant. Like, this isn't about you. But I remember being so jealous. I wanted a tragedy that people could feel sorry for me about.
God.
And I think that's just a natural childhood thing.
It's like the fucked up version of like someone getting glasses and you're like, your vision's fine, but you're like, God damn it, I want glasses.
Yeah, my kids do that all the time. My middle child's vision is perfect and my oldest needs glasses. And my middle child is like incensed that he can't wear can't wear glasses, to the point where I bought him a pair of blue light glasses.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as we got home, they were like on the ground, stepped on. He didn't give a shit, you know? They do it all the time. Like, one of them will get hurt and I'll be consoling them, like, you know, rubbing their back or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the other one will go, what about me?
Yeah.
It's like, you can't. Kids just.
I do this. I do this all the time. Like, if Britt says to the girls, like, all right, love you. Give him a kiss on the head, walked in the room. I'm like, excuse me.
Hello. I'm also a person.
Hello. I got a forehead.
Jesus Christ. Anyway.
Anyway, we did
Rachel
it.
Aviv.
Rachel Aviv.
Steve Almond.
Steve Almond. Good job, Steve.
Yep. Goodbye.
All right. Goodbye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Hickley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yeah!